I walked down the same flight of stairs my father once strode every day, and my grandfather before him. The marble with the gold pattern inlay is softly sloped from a century of heavy use, taking guests from the restaurant to the lobby. It's old, it's used, and it's still beautiful. The aged aspects of the Winter Hotel, unreplicable and historic, are what allows us to charge thousands of dollars per night. I let my hands slide down the banister and take the steps in quick succession. It's been another late night at work, going over our international expansion. Our almost finished resort in the Caribbean has shown enough promise that we're scouting locations in Greece for a second one, with the same resort feel and winter luxury, surrounded by turquoise ocean rather than New York's concrete jungle. I walk across the smooth, checkered floor of the lobby. Outside the front doors, the daylight is gone. It's late, and there'll only be a few good places left open on the block to get takeout. My staff could bring something up, but I need the walk and the air. I roll my shoulders back and feel the telltale protest of stiff muscles.
"Sir,"
Andre says from behind the front desk with a nod of greeting. He's in his mid-40s, originally from Croatia, and has an eye for impeccable detail. He's in charge of everything in reception. One of the finest men I've hired during my tenure as president of the Winter Corporation. "Evening," I say. "Is everything running smoothly?" He nods.
"Sure is. We're almost at capacity."
"Great," I say, and lengthen my stride. Flakes down the street has good enough food. I can be in and out in under half an hour, and still have enough time left over tonight to hit the gym. The sound of high heels on marble echoes behind me. The pace is furious, the speed unrelenting. A woman is racing from the emergency staircase with the wings of her camel coat open and flowing behind her. The half run alone is unusual, but it's her face that stops me in my tracks. Tears stream down her cheeks, and she reaches up to wipe at her face, her steps quickening. She looks like she's just been destroyed.
Divorce has taught me a lot of lessons. One is that cushions and towels and cutlery adorned with a couple monogram is a spectacularly bad idea. It hadn't been mine, of course, but my former mother-in-law's. But that doesn't change the fact that I now have a set of beautiful towels I don't want to use. A couple monogram is only as useful as long as the couple exists. And Percy's and mine no longer does. But the lesson that hurts the most has little to do with cutlery or the artful intertwining of our initials. No, it's all about our mutual friends. I've now learned the hard way that there's no such thing. In the trenches of divorce warfare, everyone takes a side. It had started as soon as I filed. The slow decline in texts, phone calls, invitations, brunch invites, and hellos from people we'd surrounded ourselves with during our 7 years as a couple. 4 of those married. Our mutual friends chose a side, and it was very rarely mine. Oh, our female friends were very understanding when I met them, of course. "I was so sorry to hear about it all," Maud had told me at dinner, 2 months post-filing for divorce. "Was there no way to repair it? To look past his little indiscretion? Here, let me give you the name of the couple's therapist Mark and I used when we were going through something similar. Just think about it, Sophia. You two have so much together." Yes, I'd thought. We have a shit ton of monogrammed junk. So maybe they weren't so understanding after all. Most of the people Percy and I knew were more his friends than they ever were mine. His old camaraderie of buddies from school, be it the semester he did at boarding school or his Ivy League college. His squash friends and his golf buddies and his parents' friends and their children and the entire vast ivy-coated network we'd built together in New York. Except it wasn't our network, and I didn't build it.